Toy maker. Abused. After you get rid of the bitch, you take half an hour to catch up on some admin work. You left the pad in here just in case. You pull your VM down from the cloud and write up a brief summary of your thoughts about what's going on and your revised business plan, and send it back to the operations servers. Doubtless next time you check in, there'll be some helpful notes from control. Factory wiping the pad, you shove it back in the hotel safe and pull your clothes on again. You weren't planning to stay the night here anyway, and the straight woman's presence makes it all the more important to move out. So you leave the room, walk to the fire stairs, and ascend to the ground floor. It's still daylight outside. The sun never seems to set on this fucking city. But you feel drained. It's some combination of the dour stone architecture, the weird Scottish people, a smidgen of your own paranoia, and the fact that a fucking murderer is stalking your startup. It's getting you down. Perhaps you should have hit the meow meow and taken the bitch clubbing first, taken the time to relax. But you're not planning on hanging around, and anyway, she was tedious. You've met her type before. Needy, 30-something singles. Think she's a swinger. But if you take the effort to keep her hot, the next thing you know she'll be making cow eyes at you and expecting an engagement ring. They get desperately serious when all you want is a fuck. And why are all these Anglo hotels so uptight about room service? The hell with that. You walk across the plaza in front of the hotel, a barren flagstoned plinth, towards the round theater on the other side of the road. There are some bars clustered behind it. In your rough guide overlay, they're helpfully tagged as the pubic triangle. Maybe you should have gone there instead of scouring the hotel for desperate would-be housewives. 5 minutes walking brings you to a corner where yet more of the desperately grey stone shit looms over you. They have houses with fucking battlements here, stone cannons carved into the eaves. Haven't these people heard of earthquakes? You're still a bit nervy-scratchy from the day's events, so rather than piss around outside, you nod amiably at the bouncer and duck through a brass-trimmed door into a venue that promises 200 kinds of whiskey and beer besides. You order an Irish and Coke, then look around for the darkest corner you can see and go hide in it. There's a secure notepad app on your skull phone, works with your shades. You finger twitch under the table, working out your priorities. Get your DNA off the police incident database. It's not vital, but if you can't manage it, you're going to have to go to extremes. Find someone who's died and get the records corrupted. Doable, but very costly. Find out who's after your people and where they're getting their information from. The ladder. You'd bet good money that there's a leak inside the operation. Otherwise, how else do they know who you're targeting? So you're going to set up a target. Mr. Family Man Diplomat seems like a suitable option. Fat, happy, and dumb. Move in with him, put word on the line that he's your new COO, wait for someone to try to whack him, grab the killer, and extract names. You do not commit this latter plan to your notepad. You've got to assume that anything in your skull phone is being monitored by control, and that control is leaking information to the... No, they don't exist. There are no killer lizards bleeding through from the other side of reality, the side that's all washed out and grainy grey and suicidal. That's just a delusional fantasy, a side effect of bad head meat. And you're not delusional, are you? Halfway down your drink, you notice a couple of lowlifes giving you the eyeball from across the bar. You don't move your head, but you study them back from behind your glasses. Skinny, short hair, bad skin, tracksuit and hoodie stereotypes. One of them staring and muttering to his mate, who's nodding and not looking at you. You're acutely aware, of an instant, that you're wearing the gonet on your wrist. Conspicuous consumption indeed. Shit, part of you registers, the part of you that remembers your time at school and the special education your Uncle Al gave you. The rest of you feels a pulse or squeeze of momentary happy anticipation of release, not unlike what you felt with the woman. Sex and violence are all crosswired at a low level in the brain anyway. That's what they say. You finish your glass, stand, and walk out the bar with your back straight, not looking back. You slide the glasses into their case and pocket them. There's some movement behind you. You turn a corner and cut uphill through a grey stone canyon between windowless buildings. It's twilight now, and there's movement behind you, a scuffing noise like a rat in a hurry, and a breath of air as you spin round. There's only one of them, and it's Sweaty McTracksuit, and the back of your head is no longer in front of his fist when he tries to deck you. Instead, your left heel is stamping on his right instep, you've got a lock on his arm, and you're twisting as he drops the home-fab knuckle-duster that probably came off one of your client's machines and claws at your eyes with his left hand. A second later, you've face-planted him on a paving stone. Quick scan. Two's company. For a moment, you wonder if the enemy sent him, but no. He's just a fucking low-life mugger who's taken you for a tourist, gone after your watch and your wallet. You can't be having that. So you kick him sharply in the ribs, pick up the ultra-hard plastic knuckles while he's struggling to draw breath, hold down his right hand against the concrete, and use them to ensure he'll never play Guitar Hero again. Ants. I am surrounded by fucking ants. Can't they get anything right? Even a fucking mugging? Evidently not. It looks like Peter Manuel will have to teach the burghers of Edinburgh a lesson. A lesson they won't soon forget. Liz, bereavement counselling. Mr. Hussein is pretty much right at the bottom of the list of all the people you ever expected to be doing the victim response officer tap dance for. It is, in fact, typical of how fucked up this week has become that you find yourself sitting knee to knee with him over a cup of tea, commiserating for tenuous values of commiseration. Anwar is as bent as a 3-euro note, just bright enough to think he's smarter than everyone around him, just stupid enough not to realize that they've got his number. He's a walking poster boy for the Dunning-Kruger effect. If he says he's going straight, it probably means one of his idiot friends told him shoplifting is legal. However, his lack of insight is a two-edged sword. It's glaringly obvious that he's worried sick about his cousin, who's lying dead in an upstairs bedroom while the Soko team pinned down the scene, but he's too dumb to actually help you. So you're supposed to treat him like any other victim, or potential source of material evidence in what is rapidly shaping up to be the mass murder inquiry of the century. Hence the housework questions. It only takes you 5 minutes to figure out that he is not, in fact, a killer. You don't even need the speech stress analyzer. He's not dissembling, his story lines up, and his probationware-riddled phone places him on the far side of town at the time. Everything so far checks out. And if the public CCTV confirms his movements, he's definitely off the hook. Anyway, he's not smart enough to have done something like this. Right now, he's a bit of a mess. Not quite a blubbery mass, but obviously very upset. And he's beginning to push you for details. I don't understand. What's happened to my cousin? Why are you here? Who did it? What did they do? Have you arrested anyone?
I don't know, you tell him, honestly enough. It's not as if you can give him information that might compromise an ongoing investigation. But even if that wasn't the case, the scene upstairs is more than slightly mad.
Listen, I'm going to check with my colleagues. I don't want to say anything until I know what I'm allowed to say, but I'll be right back. Drink your tea. I won't be 5 minutes.
You rise and step out into the hall, pull the door closed and nod at the PC on duty, who steps sideways to cover the door. You go upstairs. Kamal is standing on the landing outside the bathroom.
Why is it the fucking bathroom again?
Airboarding notes. He shakes his head when he sees you.
You've seen it.
What do you think? You ask him. Behind his Eurocop standard specs, Kamal's eyes are tired.
Was the Blair murder scene like this? He asks.
I don't know. Haven't examined this one yet. But you've got a good idea what to expect. Otherwise, why the IM asking you to ask Mr. Hussein about domestic appliances? You knock on the bathroom door, ignoring the yellow warning icons buzzing around it like angry hornets.
Hello, inside?
The door doesn't open, but a chat window drops front and centre. Sergeant Maddox, SOC. What's up?
Sit rep, you call.
You hear a muffled voice.
Just a mo.
Then a huge and grisly multimedia dump with about 6 gigabytes of metadata hanging off it drops across your view like a luminous crime-fighting jellyfish. In the middle, there's a doorway-framed view of the bathroom. You zoom on it. It's live. Someone's had the good taste to hang a webcam from the hook on the back of the door, so you've got the equivalent of X-ray specs. Your view is partially obstructed by Maddox and her co-workers, who are dancing the dance of the forensic bunnymen within a much smaller stage than that afforded by the bad-taste palace of the late Michael Blair. But the focus of their attention is broadly similar. No dead Warsaw Pact dictator's colonic irrigation machine here. Just a vacant-eyed, skinny guy slumped half out of the bath.
But what in James Dyson's name is the vacuum bot doing?
You don't have one of the things. Your wee flat's too small to need it. But you get the picture. It's supposed to bumble around the house, sucking on the rugs and scaring the cat, periodically retreating to its wall wart to recharge and hawk up a cricket ball-sized sphere of compacted fluff and household dirt. This is an upmarket jobby, with 2 sets of wheels so it can walk upstairs and a couple of extension hoses so it can stick its knobbly nose into crevices where the sun don't shine. It features an especially big battery, which is currently 100% discharged, having shorted out through the bathwater in which the very dead Tariq is marinating. There's a big evidence bag laid out beside the robot, and you don't need to be a technical genius to figure that cracking this case hinges on fingering whoever fitted a live wire down its snout and programmed it to go drinkies while Tariq was in the tub. If someone's tampering with domestic appliances with murder in mind, the blogosphere is going to have a cow and a half. But that's the least of your worries right now. You turn to Kamal.
You got that? You ask redundantly.
Was the other case like this? He repeats.
A bit. Shit, who are you trying to kid? You surrender to the inevitable and place the call.
Chief Inspector?
Dodgy Dicky grunts.
What's up?
I'm afraid we've definitely got another one.
You're registered on scene here, so you can add him to the access list. Moderately bent businessman in Bruntsfield, dead in the bathtub where his vacuum cleaner decided to electrocute him. I've got his cousin downstairs,
former client of mine, not currently under suspicion, sweating bullets and trying not to incriminate the deceased. The M.O. is a dead ringer for Babylon. That the deceased was in the loop on repairing broken appliances, see also Backstreet Fabbers, you leave for later. It's certainly a suggestive avenue for inquiries. Mac's initial response is unprintable. Then, hold the fort. I'll be right round. This client of yours, dinna let him leave. He hangs up immediately, and his contact status, hanging in the corner of your vision, changes to mobile. Dickie is showing worrying signs of succumbing to hands-on mode, the besetting cognitive error of any senior officer confronted by too much data. The illusion that if they just take hands-on control in the field, they can make everything come up roses. It leads to brigadiers focusing on a single infantry squad and chief inspectors interviewing suspects instead of concentrating on running the 100-headed murder team. And, of course, if you try to point this out to him, just don't go there. You hot-shoe it downstairs and back to the living room, which is becoming hard to get to. The hall is filling up with uniforms, stomping on each other's German Army surplus paratroop boots and trying to make themselves useful. You really want an opportunity to get Kamal alone and pump him, or failing that, to get Mr. Hussein to spill the beans on his cousin, assuming there are any beans to spill. But once Dickie arrives... Anwar. He's sitting in the armchair, shoulders slumped beneath the weight of an invisible storm cloud. And he looks guilty, which will never do. In a few minutes, my boss on this investigation is going to arrive. He'll want to ask you a few questions. Dickie is very old school, inclined to go off like a shaped charge in the direction of the first plausible suspect who comes to his attention. This isn't unreasonable. 90% of the time it's the right thing to do in an investigation, because 90% of the time the first plausible suspect is the right one. But you'll eat your warrant card if Anwar is smart enough to arrange a scene like the one in the bathroom upstairs, much less to have orchestrated Mikey Blair's demise. In the absence of a better target, Dickie's nostrils will start twitching in exactly the wrong direction, and he'll get all distracted and focused on the nearest Sochten graduate because it's easier than acknowledging how non-linear this investigation is going. And you don't want him to do that because, despite the ongoing bad blood between you, you are horribly aware that there's a repeat killer at large, and it would really suck if Dickie got hung up on Anwar, leaving the killer free to strike again. I'm not officially cautioning you, and you're not under arrest, my friend. But it would be really helpful if you could tell me anything you know about any criminal activities your cousin was engaged in. The slumped shoulders rise infinitesimally, then fall again. Oh, it's like that, is it? You take your glasses off and very deliberately slide them into your pocket. Anwar. You pause. What you're about to say might break your career if it comes out in the wash. If you've got any career left to break, that is. This is a murder investigation. Intelligence goes in, it doesn't come out. As long as you don't cough to any arrestable offences, we have no reason to lay a finger on you. And I can guarantee that anything you say that isn't a confession about an arrestable offence won't reach your probation officer's ears, if that's what you're worried about. Maintaining security on a murder investigation is much more important to us than telling your social worker whether you've been saying your prayers before bed. So I'm going to ask you again. Do you know anything that we should know to help us find your cousin's killer? You put your glasses back on, and while your head's bowed and you're looking elsewhere. Anwar opens up.
2 hours later, you're missing your lunch break for the sake of clogging up the meat space incident room, laying it on the line for the peanut gallery. Here's our Anwar Hussain, on probation, done time for identity theft and fraud, not very smart. He's a foot soldier, not a general. Retired foot soldier at that, or so he says. He gets a call from his wife, who got it from the first bystander, Mrs. Begum, to go visit Mrs. Begum and her son, the victim. He arrived on the scene after our first responder and Sergeant McBride. Because he's on release, we have his probationware record, and I can confirm that he's been nowhere near the scene of crime for 2 days. Subject to confirmation by municipal CCTV, but it really doesn't look like he did it. However, our Anwar is a bit of a wide boy, and his first reaction was to clam up. I was eventually able to determine that he's got a guilty conscience over some work the victim had asked him to do. There might be an issue of possible violation of probation terms here, but Mr. Hussain is eager to assure us that he hadn't actually got round to doing anything illegal as yet. There's much rolling of eyes from the peanut gallery at this point, which you deliver with ironic lack of emphasis.
I didn't mean to put my hand through the window and take the wallet. It just sort of happened.
So you feel the need to clear your throat. He coughed to it voluntarily, and more to the point, he handed over the material which he claims his cousin Tariq gave him to work on, along with the device. It's downstairs in forensics being imaged right now. If he hasn't touched it, then it may give us some insight into the murderer's motivation. Assuming there is a murderer, something in the back of your mind nudges. Because if you were wrong about there being no such thing as an artificial intelligence, things could get really embarrassing, couldn't they? DCI McLeish, for he's back from the Hussain residence, gives you the hairy eyeball. What sort of business was Mr. Hussain involved in, do you know? You stare right back at him. I arrested him 3 years ago in the course of an ongoing investigation into an identity fraud ring. He coughed to a variety of charges, including spearfishing, ownership of stolen authentication credentials, unauthorized access to personal account details, and internet banking fraud. Came to court, entered a guilty plea, 2 years in Sochten, cut on appeal to 1+1. Interestingly, Anwar was the only body we bagged on that case. I'm certain he wasn't working alone, but you know how these internet cases are. You tap your forehead. Dickie's eyebrows waggle, then he nods deeply, satisfied. There's stuff you can say and stuff you can't say on the record, and everything that's said anywhere in a police station is recorded under rules of evidence these days. But waggling eyebrows and forehead tapping don't show up in the automatic speech-to-text transcripts. What you just sent via monkey space, bypassing cop space entirely, is that you know stuff, but you don't want to contaminate the investigation by introducing hearsay or out-of-band intelligence. And Dickie, for once, agrees with you. He doesn't want you screwing up his investigation either. 3 victims so far, he rumbles. Inspector Aslan, you have some input. Kamal is fidgeting with his glasses.
We have 2 more, he says diffidently. 1 in Sofia, 1 in Trieste. That's all in the past hour, bringing the running total to 11.
Dickie looks simultaneously aghast and almost, in an odd way, hopeful. It's a clusterfuck, but it's not his clusterfuck. He's merely holding up a small corner, a few fragments of fatal fuckuppery.
Evidence?
A uniform at the back sticks up her hand.
Got one on the Crowler case, she offers.
Go ahead.
The warrant trawl of the National Network Monitoring Database flagged up some chatroom transcripts. They match input from an avatar associated with an IP address
allocated to Vivian Crawler's broadband connection. Assuming it's her, she had an, vivid fantasy life.
Ears prick up all round. Nothing gets your attention in a briefing room like a drop of special sauce on the great and the good. Hot sauce, even.
A number of inquiries about bondage practices involving plastic wrap and mattresses full of banknotes.
Bless her, the fresh-faced constable is looking even more rosy-cheeked than usual.
The aforementioned user posted a number of scenarios and there are some downloads too. Stories centred on being immobilised and restrained while fully clothed, in proximity to large amounts of money. We're currently trying to track down some chat room contacts.
It's too much. You hear wackier stories from the twinks at CC's every Saturday night you go clubbing, but a fair proportion of the assembled officers are of a, shall we say, small C conservative upbringing. As for the rest, some of them aren't as hard-boiled as they'd like to think. Muttered disbelief and the odd titter sweep the room.
"Silence!" roars Dodgy Dicky, the veins on the side of his neck standing out.
He sounds surprised at himself. "Sarah, if you'd like to continue."
That's all I've really got right now, sir, until we question her known contacts. Details in the case file...
She flips a reference into the investigation space hovering above the big conference table.
"The Crawler post-mortem examination report won't be available until tomorrow," Dicky announces. "But we have a preliminary. According to the pathologist, it looks like a massive allergic reaction while the subject was restrained. Anaphylactic shock. They're still looking for the cause, whatever she was allergic to, but suggest it's something that was introduced into her apartment's atmosphere while she was immobilised. I gather Ian sent the empty air freshener cartridge in the bathroom for analysis."
You tap Kamal on the shoulder and jerk your head in the direction of the door. He blinks at you, then nods.
Outside you march directly, or rather via a bunch of scuffed and flicker-lit corridors and stairs that resemble a giant hamster maze that's gone to seed, to your own office in the ICIU. Kamal tags along like your guilty shadow.
"I seem to recall there was a book about it years ago," you tell him, as you take the fire door into the car park, then the back corridor past the Airfast control room, where the pilots sit in their twilight virtual cockpits, alert and ready to dive their stealthed carbon-fibre drones on the heads of any hapless dog-walker who forgets to scoop up the poop their mutts just dropped on the meadows, down past the flammable store and along the side of the old stables. About a guy who was into wrapping Roy Orbison in cling film, saran wrap. My mum used it to show me why I should never go with strangers. I had nightmares about kitchenware for years.
"You think the accountant..."
You pause on the threshold of the ICIU suite. "I refuse to speculate. It's unprofessional, and besides, she might have had a perfectly innocent reason for owning a metric shitload of cancelled banknotes in an obsolete currency. Not that you'd catch me shrink-wrapping myself to a pile of used banknotes. The stuff's lousy with germs. People sneeze on it." You take a tiny pleasure from Kamal's expression of cumulatively deepening distaste.
"This is my office, the ICIU, and here's Detective Sergeant Cunningham. Moxie, this is D.I. Aslan from Europol. He's here to help us."
Kamal probably won't spot the slight emphasis on the penultimate word, but you can be sure Moxie will, and the warning eye flicker. Your attitude to Kamal has changed somewhat since you departed to collect him this morning. Was it only 5 hours ago? But Moxie isn't Mr. Sensitive McNew Age and can't be guaranteed to pick that up. You can quite easily live without him unintentionally reopening hostilities.
"Great, Skipper. I could use some help. It's been one damn thing after another this morning.
I've got 6 pending RFIs from some big intelligence investigation CID are running. Your heart sinks. Is it Operation Babylon, you ask? How did you know? Moxie does his best hamster nose-rubbing imitation at you. Meet Operation Babylon's Europol liaison. You point at Kamal, who's looking around with an expression that speaks volumes in monosyllables. His giz turns especially glassy as he spots Mox's animated goatsy dance digiframe, for which you make a mental note to bollock him later. Visiting brass could get entirely the wrong idea. It's a black hole, Moxie, coming to swallow us. What have you got in your queue? You settle Kamal down with a seat and a pad, then spend the next 10 minutes with Moxie dissecting. A request for information about shrink-wrap fetish clubs in Midlothian. Demands that someone in IT support decode the charge sheet you filed against one Mr. Hussein A. back in the day. Conspiracy to bamboozle the police, suggests Moxie, identity theft charges being confusing to officers more normally accustomed to breach of the peace and public order offences. An urgent inquiry from a backgrounder on spam filters. You boost that one to priority A and sling it at your own job queue. A query from the desk sergeant at Gayfield Square as to whether he can arrest someone for running a homebrew fabricator. That'll be a no, not without probable cause, and fuck knows how that one slipped into the Babylon queue. And a query about identity theft and a person of interest claiming to be Mikey Blair's boyfriend who left a DNA sample and a junk identity trail. Which is just peachy, because if you dig anything up on the random Mr. Christie and present it to Dickie, he really will have a coronary on the briefing room floor. Kamal clears his throat. Yes?
I have an update from the office. They have a causal chain for one of our fatalities.
You would expect the man to look smug at this point, but he doesn't. Haunted more like. What? Kamal shakes his head.
Vito Morricone, dead in Palermo, a Yahoo Yahoo boy. He died in a kitchen accident.
Moxie shakes his head.
A kitchen accident? Yes, he was electrocuted by a deliberately miswired food processor.
You wince. You've had cooking incidents like that. Kamal continues.
It was a high-end machine, able to heat or chill as well as mincing and mixing. Programmable. Networked. You can leave cold ingredients in it and switch it on before you leave work. Even change recipes remotely. His partner says that it broke 8 months ago, and Morricone took it to a backstreet repair shop, where they fixed it for him. The case is stainless steel, a replacement part.
He shakes his head. What kind of replacement?
The report doesn't explain this thing, but the local investigators report that the fixer bought the replacement part design online from a cheap pirate shop, not from the manufacturer's website. It came with installation instructions, which he followed. Once installed, the machine could be remotely induced to short its input power supply through the case.
You give a low whistle of appreciation. Moxie claps, slowly. Murder? Smoking gun?
Yes, but...
Kamal looks troubled.
The fixer doesn't appear to know anything. Who supplied the sabotage component design, and why? The investigating magistrate connected to the same pirate design site and bought the same part. It is apparently harmless. And who sent the signal to activate it? We don't know yet.
But it's an assassination. A well-planned one. You snap your fingers. Tariq Hussein... The vacuum robot! The IM you got while you were talking to Anwar rises to the top of your mind. Tariq got things fixed. Anwar said something about a kitchen appliance that had broken. Huh. You pull up a memo window. I want to know who fixed Tariq's vacuum cleaner and when. Ask Mrs. Hussain about it. And, the penny drops, Mr. Blair's enema machine. Who repaired it last? Minute those to Babylon, you tell Moxie. He nods and keyboards it into the intelligent wiki, where some poor grunt will funnel it into Mac's inbound workstream, and Mac, or one of his assistant managers, will assign it a priority level and add it to some other detective's to-do list. Policing, as with all procedural jobs, expands to fill all the time and consume all the resources available for it. And a job like this one is too big to handle in a half-assed manner. It's a point of pride among the former nations of the United Kingdom that the murder clear-up rate is in Three Sigma's territory, somewhere over 92%. But it takes bucket loads of manpower to get there, and process-oriented management and intelligence-supported workflow and human resources tracking to keep the minimum investigative team of 50-plus detectives properly coordinated. Most of the public still believe in Sherlock Holmes or Inspector Rebus, the lone genius with an eye for clues. And it suits the brass to maintain the illusion of inscrutable detective insight for political reasons. But the reality is that behind the magic curtain, there's a bunch of uniformed desk pilots frantically shuffling terabytes of information, forensic reports and mobile phone traffic metadata and public webcam streams and directed interviews, looking for patterns in the data deluge spewing from the fire hose. Indeed, a murder investigation is a lot like a Mechanical Turk, a machine that resembles a marvellous piece of artificial intelligence software, oracular in its acuity, but that under the hood turns out to be the work of huge numbers of human pieceworkers coordinating via network. Crowdsourcing by cop, in other words. If you're one of the pieceworkers in a Mechanical Turk, or one of the rewrite rules inside Searle's Chinese Room, the overall pattern of the job may be indiscernible, lost in an opaque blur of seemingly random subtasks. And if you're one of the detectives on a murder case, your immediate job, determining who last repaired a defective vacuum cleaner, may seem equally inexplicable. But there's method in my motion, as you'll learn for yourself. You spend the next 2 hours with Moxie, churning through queries from Operation Babylon. Partway through, Kamal disappears. To the toilet, you think at first, then to the briefing room, you decide, returning towards the end. You do lunch in the on-site canteen, communicating in defensive monosyllables. After his contribution from Palermo, he has nothing more to offer you. After lunch, you both attend the afternoon briefing in D-31. Then you sort Kamal out with a tablet, and he turns out to be surprisingly useful at handling those low-level queries you delegate to him. You update the ICIU shift roster for the next week and attend to another heap of inbound administrivia before finally clocking off your shift and going home via the hair salon. Home in your wee flat, you kick your shoes off and hang your jacket, visit the bathroom, and take a good close look at your new hairdo. It's always hard to tell for sure at the hairdresser's, but here you can take your time and not worry about being unduly critical in front of the perfectly coiffured girl with the scissors and the long memory for casual insults from clients. You tilt your head and narrow your eyes, and after a minute you decide that, yes, you can live with it. It's shorter, but more importantly, it's regular. As businesslike as your choice of footwear. Rest easy. Nobody's going to be passing sly remarks about your hairdo or your sensible shoes in the canteen behind your back. Locker room culture will never die. It just goes underground, as you know, to your cost. You have plenty of time for a long, comfortable lie in the bath, followed by a TV dinner. You plant yourself on the sofa under your tablet, surfing the web while the vacuum sniffs and nudges around the corners of the living room carpet, as the evening grows old along with your thoughts, which, as usual, are increasingly bored and lonely. Burnout is such an ugly turn of phrase, and in any case it doesn't quite fit. It's more like you ran out of fuel halfway across the ocean, and you're gliding now, the sight of your crash landing approaching implacably but still hidden from you by the horizon of your retirement. That's you in a nutshell, drifting slowly down towards lonely old age, the fires of ambition having flamed out years ago. There was a time when, after working hours, you'd be off to the gym, or auditing a distance learning course or some other worthy pursuit. But these days, it's hard to see the point anymore. The sad truth, which only dawned on you after you were 15 years down this path, is that it doesn't mean anything. Your job, your vocation, your life's calling. You're like a priest who awakens one day and realizes that his God has been replaced by a cardboard cutout, and he's no longer able to ignore his own disbelief. And, like the priest, you've sacrificed all hope of a normal life on the altar of something you no longer believe in. Heaven knows, it's not as if the job doesn't need doing. 15 years in the Force has taught you more about the stupid, petty, vicious idiocy of your fellow humans than you ever wanted to know. It's also startled you, very occasionally, with their generosity, intelligence, and altruism. Very occasionally. But policing, crime prevention and detection is a Red Queen's race. You have to run as fast as you possibly can just to stand still. You can collar criminals until the cows come home, and there'll still be a never-ending supply of greedy fuckwits and chancers. It's like there's a law of nature. Not only is the job never done, the job can never be done. And then you hit your career derailment, passed over for promotion and sidelined into running the ICIU. And that's even worse. The movies playing inside people's heads every day are a million times nastier than what's out on the streets. Your colleagues have got no fucking idea what people daydream and fantasize about. It's some kind of miracle you're not dealing with 1,000 Hungerford massacres a day, going by what ICIU shows you. The sad fact is, the actual crimes that are committed are a pale shadow of the things people fantasize about. Even the poor impulse control cases who clog up the holding cells at the sheriff's court mostly have some rudimentary inhibitions that hold chaos at bay, most of the time. But for the past couple of years, it's been sapping your will to live, never mind your ability to believe in the job. You're just thinking about retreating to the bedroom, a lonely end to a boring evening, when you get a text. It's from Dorothy. How old school, you think? You home? She asks. Yes. Can I come round? She capitalizes and uses correct written grammar, as formal as the way she dresses. Need company? Your heart flip-flops at the promise of company. Sure, you send, trying not to sound overexcitable, and tag it with your address and directions. Check the time. It's 10:30, for heaven's sake. Doesn't she have to go to work tomorrow? Don't you have to go to work tomorrow? Your heart flip-flops again, and suddenly you feel hot and bothered. But a cool, collected part of you asks, "Didn't you have a date for Saturday?" Dorothy's the planning kind. Why so sudden? "Be right round," she texts again. "Need to talk." You shove your tablet away hurriedly, start to run fingers through your hair, then stop. You're a mess, and there's no time to do anything about it. Shit. Precisely 8 minutes and 42 seconds later, the doorbell rings. It's her as you knew it would be. Swearing quietly, you buzz her up. The bed's made, the sofa cushions are plumped, there's coffee waiting in the cafetiere, in the kitchen, if you need it. Fuck knows what this is about, but... You open the door. It's Dorothy. She looks at you with red-rimmed eyes, steps forward into your open arms, and begins to weep.
Anwar. Sleepwalk.
The cops don't so much let you go as politely direct you to the door with a stern admonition to keep out of their hair. There's a crossed wire somewhere. They don't seem to know whether to treat you as a victim of crime, subtype next of kin, or person of interest in ongoing investigation, subtype old lag. You're numb inside by the time Inspector Butthurt finishes dragging the sorry story of Tariq's business out of you. You probably didn't incriminate yourself over much. As she pointed out, it's a murder investigation. They don't care about your probation as long as you're not plotting any bank robberies. But after you finished spilling in her lap, she wheeled in her colleague, Chief Inspector McHaggis, who's an entirely different species of asshole, with his raj attitude and aggressively bristling moustache. He glared at you like he'd found you stuck to the bottom of his size 12 paraboots, and curtly told you that he'd be in touch, and in the meantime, please do something about your mother-in-law, who's still wailing up a storm in the kitchen whenever she remembers. Speaking of remembering, you remember phoning Bibi, who tells you to phone Imam Hafiz, so you phone the Imam, who agrees to call your father-in-law, then come right round, and you wait on the street corner for him to show up as, meanwhile, everyone in the local community wanders by, casually checking out the scene with their phone cams and occasionally pausing to tut-tut and share furtive condolences with you, all the time wondering if you are in fact some kind of serial killer and waiting for the police to come and arrest you. It's truly mortifying. And so, some hours later, when Bibi has efficiently squirreled numb-faced Talib and his grieving bride away in one of the hotels on Lothian Road and organised a rota of hot-and-cold-running daughters-in-law and nieces to sit and keep them company through the long night, you tiptoe away to a certain pub on the far side of Carlton Hill, where the gnome is waiting for you with a warm pint and a quizzical stare. He glances at your face and shoves the beer in front of you. You take it wordlessly and chug most of it straight back. The gnome looks concerned. "What kind of way is that to treat a pint?" he asks, then pauses, laboriously taking note of your face. "Ah, I see. Would you be in need of another?" You nod. He makes himself scarce in the direction of the bar, despite those stumpy legs he can shift when he needs to, and you put the remains of your first pint down on the table and try to shove away the enormous hollowness behind your breastbone. It won't budge. You glare at the pint. There's maybe an answer of sorts to your dilemma hidden in the glass, but you're not sure how to frame the question. To get bloated or not to get bloated? Bibi'll scream at you if you come to bed legless and stinking of alcohol, but right now you don't really care about that. Plenty of time to shrug it off as an aberration later. The real question is, why? A new glass, clone of the old one, appears under your nose. You nod. Thank you.
What's the story?
The gnome asks, not ungently. "My cousin Tariq's dead," you tell him, wanting the words to sting. Instead the gnome perks up. "Was it you who killed him?" he asks with pseudo-professional cheer. "The police think it was murder." You finish the first pint. The gnome deflates, humour hissing away. "Oh, lad! I had a visit from one of Colonel Datka's people this afternoon. I don't think it's a coincidence."
Shite!
The brass-necked gears are turning behind his eyes.
What makes you say that?
Tariq gave me a little job yesterday. You take a first mouthful of the second pint. Your lips feel comfortably numb. Testing a chunk of a web app offline.
That's no kind of connection, lad. He pauses. Coincidences happen.
You feel like punching him for a moment. coincidences like someone murdered him right after he gave me a wee job while I have the attention of our friends from Bishkek. You have the distinct sensation that Adam is giving you the hairy eyeball, wondering if you're reliable. What do you think the web app's part of? Honeytrap, front end for a botnet, something like that. You take another sip. Grow your penis, cheap off-license gene therapies for that annoying melanoma, holidays in the sun with added drive-through liver transplants, the usual. In other words, it's the same the usual that put you inside Sochten for a year. And now Tariq's dead. What happened? I don't know. Got a call from Bibi, who heard it from Aunt Sammy, who found him. When I went round, I walked into a cop convention. They figured out soon enough it wasn't me what did it. You ken where this is going. Don't worry, I didn't breathe your name. I had to cough to working on the side for Tariq, but I figure what he gave me isn't majorly incriminating, and anyway, it's a murder investigation. They won't be blabbing to Mr. Weber. The gnome turns an even whiter shade of fish-belly pink than is his wont. I'll thank you for doing that much. He raises his glass and drinks deeply. Do you know how Tariq died? No. The ignorance burns your throat. They wouldn't tell me anything except that... except... You can't bring yourself to finish it. He leans forward. Tell me about Colonel Datka's man. Adam is treating the shrapnel of your life like some kind of puzzle game, you realize, just like Inspector Butthurt. The momentary flash and sizzle of resentment nearly throws what's left of your beer in his face. But what stills your hand is knowing that he's trying to help, in his slightly askew, borderline aspy way. Help. You need it. So you tell him. He scared the shit out of me, even though he was polite. Eyes like a detective, you know? Only with a drum of unset concrete instead of handcuffs if you fucked him off. I do believe fear reveals your hitherto unplumbed poetic depths. The gnome is scrutinizing you like he's got you under a microscope. What did he want? A padded envelope from the office safe and a bag of bread mix. You shiver. He opened the envelope. There was a baggie in it with a passport, other papers, and he gave me a suitcase to take home. It's got a combination lock. Said he may need to stay with me for a couple of days from tomorrow. You shudder again. Those eyes. Well, you're in it now, the gnome observes calmly. In what? That remains to be seen. He leans forward. But I've got a fair idea it means the end game is in train. Listen, can you lay your hands on 5 grand? Put it on credit if you have to, but you won't be able to pay it back for a month. What has that got to... It's time to cash out. Eh? You think fast. There's the 2 grand you staked Uncle Hassan a couple of years ago, back before everything caught up with you. He's probably good for at least one, maybe more. You've still got your credit card, but in these deflationary times you can only draw 500 in cash against it. You could pawn some of Bibi's jewellery to cover the rest, but she's bound to notice, and she'll want to know what you're doing with the money. And hurrying right behind the hamster wheel spin of your financial calculations is your native suspicion of anyone asking you to cough up cash on the barrel for something too good to be true. Why now, Adam? What's the sudden hurry? The sudden hurry, dear boy, is that your employers didn't go out looking to hire honorary consuls at not inconsiderable cost on a whim. They obviously had a purpose in mind, and with a purpose goes a plan, and with a plan goes a timetable. I have been waiting for a sign that they were ready to go to the end game, and the arrival of your colonel's man means things are about to get too hot for you to stay in the bathtub. You'll be wanting out while the water's still clean enough that the police aren't taking an interest, so it's time to cash out. And how precisely am I going to do that? Adam bares his teeth at you. You're going to do as I tell you and short a particular national bank's bonds. Trust me, you'll make a killing. There's no solace to be had in getting stinking drunk with the gnome, so you take your less usual route home, up the hill and through the graveyard, in search of a casual shag. There's a younger man up there, short-haired and heavily accented, a small-town incomer escaping from the usual, but with his feet under him enough to know the places to haunt. You make brief small talk before he leads you round the back of an overgrown crypt. Then it's hard up against the lichen-encrusted stone, tongues grappling hungrily and his hand down your trousers, squeezing your cock. He tastes of stale roll-ups and sweat, and when you go down on him, he washes away the memory of the day's horror with furtive joy. After he sucks you off in turn, you stumble away in disarray, drained and feeling curiously vacant. You're late, and you feel like a complete fraud. Some family man you are, with the touch of another's lips on your bell end. But at least Bibi isn't there to stare at you in silent irritation or chide you for drinking again. When you get home, it's quiet and empty. Your wife is off aunt-sitting and has taken the kids to run errands or something. There's an uneaten portion of rice sitting in her fancy rice cooker, and she's left some dal in the karai to go cold for you in silent reproach. You fumble through the kitchen drawers until you find what you're looking for, a pair of plastic chopsticks. Bibi likes a Cantonese takeaway once in a while. Then climb the stairs with heavy tread, pull down the attic hatch and ascend, wondering what you're going to find. Adam slid a dagger of curiosity between the slats of your misery and paranoia. Investment opportunities aside, it's time to find out what the little fuck's playing with. Your den is suffocatingly overwarm from the summer evening sun, and you feel ill at ease, as if your personal space is under siege. The stranger's suitcase squats in the corner like an enemy garrison, a forbidding reminder of ill-advised treaties. Tariq's old pad sprawls out from behind the fridge. You stretch the metaphor until you see the fallen tombstone of a forgotten soldier and shiver despite the heat. The brewing bucket lies where you left it, under the beam of early evening sunlight sluicing through the velux. There's a yeasty smell in the air, like rising bread dough, and the wee airlock thingy sticking up from the lid burps an alien curse as you stare at it. It's a fab of sorts, the gnome told you, a new kind of fab, or a really old one, depending on your perspective. Transmutation, liquid bread, water of life, alcohol. Not like the desktop fabs Tariq and his mates are using to run off air guns and sex toys these days. This is about using yeast cells as a platform for synthetic biology. As the gnome explained it to you at great length, there will be an exam later, Anwar. In normal cells, there's DNA, which is transcribed into RNA, which in turn is used as a punch card template by protein manufacturing machines called ribosomes. Each three words of DNA data, codons, correspond to a single amino acid out of a palette of 21. The ribosomes read the codons, grab amino acids bound to carrier molecules out of the soupy intracellular medium, and glue them together to form new proteins or enzymes. But in these cells there's a whole new biology. It uses four codons to represent a much wider range of amino acids, many of which are entirely artificial. Some of them code for the protein components of the molecular assembly line that replaces the boring nature 1.0 ribosomes in the mechanosystem. Others code for enzymes that synthesize the exotic new amino acids the synthetic biochemistry runs on. There's bootstrap code written for old-style ribosomes to get the new system up and running. That's what the health food supplement switched on. Once it's running, the yeast cells are redundant, just a convenient platform for servicing the nanosystem. Not that this is about shiny Star Trek nanites. Oh no, we're not that advanced. Nanotechnology is the shiny new magic dessert topping, floor wax, pixie dust of tomorrow, and always will be. This stuff is just synthetic biochemistry, with some funky new tools for handling bucky tubes and exotic amino acids. Nothing strange about it at all, except that it's bubbling away in the bucket in the corner of your den, and it smells like money, which is always enough to secure your exclusive attention. What's in the bucket, Anwar? Adam gave you some helpful pointers. If it's full of yellow crystalline sediment, back away slowly. But no, that's not so likely. You glance over your shoulder at the intruder's suitcase, but it just sits there, eyeless and unspeaking. Too many ideas are jostling in your head, seeking attention. Bread mix, Colonel Datka's man, Tariq's chat room, the stuff you didn't tell Inspector Butthurt about. Tariq's unhealthy interest in making sure his chat room environment wasn't as well guarded against malware as it looked. His secret VPN access to the web crime bulletin board's plausible deniability. And then there are the dark suspicions you don't dare voice even to yourself as yet. How accidental is all this? Where did Adam hear about the Issyk Kulistan gig? Thoughts fermenting in your head, you lever up the rim of the bucket lid and look inside. The bucket smells of old socks and the broken promises of a hostile future, musty and somehow warm. You peer in and see only dirty grey-brown water, a scum adhering to its surface, bubbles forming at the edges. It's slightly iridescent, as if you'd spilled a drop of diesel oil on top. Is that all? You think, disappointed, and dip the chopsticks in it. The kitchen utensils don't spontaneously catch fire or dissolve or morph into brightly coloured machine parts. You stir the scum on the surface around a bit, and it crinkles and crumples against them. Then you pull them out again. A rope of congealed, filthy scum sticks to the chopsticks, dribbling water back into the bucket. Yuck! You raise the chopsticks and the floating sheet dangles from them, mucilaginous, like an elephant-sized snotter. You cast them aside and they curl together, landing on the carpet in a stringy mass under the window. You clamp the lid down on the bucket of spoiled whatever it is and shake your head. Probably you'll have to take it downstairs, pour it down the toilet. Hope the environmental health wardens don't have surveillance robots lurking in the sewers. It'd be just your luck to be busted for possession of an illegal chemical factory. Assuming the thing hasn't died or been infected by 60 kinds of bacteria. You climb downstairs wearily and head for the bedroom. It's been a long day, what with a visit from Colonel Datka's man and the unspeakable event at Talib's. At least Bibi's taken care of the kids, you think.